This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The theory is you have to earn a place in each postseason, but that's a theory fraught with flaws. And here's the major reason. You needn't be so great, you needn't be among the best, if you reside among the NFC teams in the West. It's likewise true that you can long dream big among the least productive teams in football if the AFC's flat east is where you hang your helmet. You can make the playoffs there if you can go 500, and you'll still have room to spare. Joining me now to discuss the good fortune of teams that find themselves in divisions where only one club is over 500, as well as various other matters pertaining to pigskin, is Paul Attner, who writes about pro football for the Sporting News. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. I'm trying to figure out how we can go through life just a little bit over 500, you know?
It's an ongoing battle.
It is a trick, isn't it?
Were you able to gaze upward from your Thanksgiving plate piled high with all the fixings in time to witness Denver's overtime win over Dallas on Thanksgiving?
Yes, I cleared away the turkey just enough to get a glimpse of the TV set. And I'm glad I did. It was a good game. I thought the better team won. They shouldn't have, but the better team won. I think it kind of set the stage for what we're going to see in the postseason, because I think both teams will be in it, and both teams are capable of making the Super Bowl, quite frankly.
Well, the Cowboys' loss creates a bit of a gridlock in the NFC East. So, can the 4-6 Philadelphia Eagles take the division?
In their dreams? Next year? The poor Eagles. It's one thing to go through all these injury situations, you lose your quarterback, but then have to put up with the Owens debacle and the stupidity of him and his agent and what it's done to a really nice organization that I think tries to do things the right way. But they made the mistake of thinking, like all organizations that kind of get full of themselves, that they could handle anyone, including a guy who actually said, gee, you know, I want to play with you guys. Well, when it comes to Owens, that's not nearly a big enough commitment, as they found out.
Well, the aforementioned LaFair Owens saw an arbitrator uphold his suspension this week. So when do the Raiders sign him?
When Al Davis can clear salary cap room. But, you know, it's probably right away we think of the Raiders, and it's a logical destination, but that's not going to happen. I mean, I'd love to see it. It'd be great to write about, but it's not going to happen. But, you know, we're going to see, you know, the great interesting thing about this. The root of Owens' unhappiness with the Eagles was he wanted to get paid more money. Well, now, when the Eagles finally do release him in the offseason, he's not going to get even what he was earning with the Eagles, much less more money, because no one is going to pay him close to market value because no one trusts him at all. So he's probably going to get a one-year contract at a low salary. And, you know, my question is he going to accept that or not? So it's you know, he's really got himself into a kind of catch-22 here that he did not envision when all this began.
All right. As I look over the standings, several questions occur to me. Number one, is this the year the Seattle Seahawks finally take home the Paul Tagliabue Memorial Chalice?
It seems unlikely. You know, they're a nice team, and Mike Holmgren's done a really good job of coaching, his best job of coaching since he left Green Bay. I just don't like the team. There's something about them. I don't know. It's defensively, they're not very physical and not very tough, and because of that, I just cannot embrace the notion during this holiday period.
All right, Paul, as you will perhaps recall, I actually went to an NFL game this season, and I saw the Chicago Bears look horrible against the Cincinnati Bengals some weeks ago, but now the Bears, new scourge of the NFC North?
I tell you, I mean, you know, we're going from Seattle, the Bears, another team I can't embrace. I mean, we're doing unembraceable moments here.
Unembraceable you.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's in the holiday spirit. You know, I wrote something about the Bears a few weeks ago and not very flattering, and I'm still getting emails and blogs about it, and there's a lot of unhappy Bear fans with me. The Bears are so one-dimensional, and the Ravens won exactly the same way, won a Super Bowl, so it's not out of, you know, comprehension they could do it. But when your offense is basically incapable of scoring more than 14 points a game unless your defense helps you, I don't know how you can possibly win a Super Bowl that way, and I just don't think they can do it.
All right, enough NFC talk, and on to the AFC, where the Indianapolis Colts are a rather healthy undefeated 10-0 with six games to go. I predict that the Arizona Cardinals will trip them up on the final day of the regular season. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, they'll be overlooking them, won't they?
Looking past them to the Super Bowl.
This is it'll be really something to watch, because when they get to the last game of the season, if they aren't undefeated, with the playoffs coming up and a chance to win the Super Bowl, the logical thing for a coach to do is rest his starters. Well, you know, obviously, if they're 15-0 and they have a chance to make history, you're not going to rest your starters. You play your starters, a guy gets hurt, Peyton Manning, whatever, and then, you know, poor Tony Dungy is going to be second guess to his retirement. So it would be one of those wonderful little dilemmas that that people like me would second guess forever, and of course that's what we live for.
Indianapolis has a bit of a tough schedule, though, from
on
in. Pittsburgh, Tennessee, Jacksonville, San Diego, and Seattle before Arizona. Maybe they don't get to the end of the season
undefeated.
No, I don't
think they will. Bill, they're really a team that's capable of going undefeated because of the fact that they're so difficult to stop on offense, and their defense, despite what we saw against Cincinnati, is enough better to get a few more stops a game, force the other team to punt the ball a few more times than they did last year. And once you give the ball too many times to their offense, it's really hard to beat them. But Jacksonville's always played them very tough. Their defense seems to be geared to be able to stop what the Colts try to do. San Diego, despite their record, is I think, going to be in the playoffs and is a very, very good football team. And then, you know, Pittsburgh is really physical, and that's a team that Indy has a hard time dealing with because their defense is not physical. So, no, I think they got three very difficult obstacles here, and they're going to lose one of those games.
The New England Patriots have pretty much dominated the league over the last 4 years. They slipped up once and failed to win the Super Bowl. But, you know, parity pretty much took a dive at that point. Is parity back now? The Patriots are 6-4.
Well, I mean, parity is partly shaped by injury. And you know, the Patriots are seeing what injury and the loss of coordinators can do. And that's what part of this is all about, that, you know, when you're very good, you lose assistant coaches who are very valuable to you. And those guys, you know, Romeo Crennel and Charlie Weiss were very valuable to the Patriots. Toss in injuries, toss in the fact that they've also lost some players to free agency, and all that takes a toll after a while. And it doesn't take much in this league to lose one step, you know, like the aging running back. They've lost a step, and everybody's right there catching up with them. So, they're I would not overlook them completely, but they keep suffering these injuries, and there's a point where even they have to yell uncle, and I think they're pretty close to yelling it right now.
Paul Attner covers the NFL for the Sporting News, and he joins me every few downs to discuss the gridiron goings-on. Thank you, Paul.
I enjoyed it, Bill. Thank you.
For hockey fans, this is the sound of joy. Sticks and pucks and blades on the ice. But many have wondered whether fans would be forgiving enough to return to NHL arenas after the protracted silence of the lockout and the missed season. Reporter Jason Margolis recently attended games in sunny Southern California, and he has this report.
When the second half of the baseball season was canceled in 1994, fans were bitter. Attendance plummeted by 28% the next season. It took 5 years for Major League Baseball fans to return in force. But the hockey fan is a different breed. Irvine resident John Logue closely monitored the hockey lockout and the roller coaster negotiations.
It was pretty much, you know, the equivalent of getting dumped, getting a small ray of hope, and then getting your heart completely smashed.
When he's not selling insurance, the 32-year-old runs a hockey chat room and website dedicated to the Los Angeles Kings. When the hockey lockout finally ended this summer, Logue immediately put back on his favorite Kings jersey.
I don't have any kids, but I mean, I kind of feel like it was probably how a lot of people feel when they have their firstborn. It was, it was the next best thing to winning a championship.
Logue might sound extreme, but he's not unique. Diehard hockey fans have welcomed the players back with open arms.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome your mighty Gunsman
Hall. At the Arrowhead Pond in Anaheim, season ticket holders and diehards are back, wearing their jerseys, pins, and hats. And many like 40-somethings Mark and Christy Squires wear trademark duck calls around their necks.
And will you do that throughout the entire game? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
You'll hear a lot of that in the games.
We still shout a lot, but it helps me because I need to talk the next day to jobs. So.
Los Angeles Times columnist Helene Elliott says getting these fans back wasn't the problem.
I mean, anybody you're going to find here is going to be so cuckoo, and I say that affectionately, that, you know, they'll take a kick in the face from the NHL and come back and ask for more.
In October, the NHL set attendance records with arenas filled to 92% of capacity. 23 of the 30 teams drew fans in numbers equal to or greater than pre-lockout levels. But in Southern California, the hockey faithful are few and far between. The Mighty Ducks are drawing just over 13,000 fans a game. That's third worst in the league and 1,500 fewer per game than before the lockout. Up the road, the LA Kings draw a little better, but overall attendance is down slightly. Helene Elliott says in Southern California, the Ducks and the Kings simply need a bigger base of support.
It's making the leap from the dedicated fan to bringing in the casual fan, to making this an alternative. Gee, honey, what do we do tonight? I don't know, let's go to the Duck game. How many times does that happen?
That conversation surely takes place in the hockey-obsessed northern outposts of the continent, like Calgary, where attendance in October was up 23%. But hockey is a harder sell down here.
Because there are so many alternatives. And it's not only in sports, but I think in just the lifestyle here in Southern California. You can go to the beach, you go to the mountains, you go to Mexico, you go to Mammoth.
Bob Wagner is the chief marketing officer for the Mighty Ducks. Like many teams, the Ducks cut season ticket prices by 5% to try and lure fans back. The Ducks also gave out free parking and food for the first three games to season ticket holders. But Wagner says, as a 12-year-old team, the Ducks have a big job ahead of them.
And that's why our fan development becomes so important, because we are developing a lot of fans that are kids and working in schools and stuff, so that there's a pipeline of people that understand what this franchise is about, and then ultimately they could buy group tickets or season tickets or individual tickets and be part of our overall fan base.
Jean-Sébastien Giguère is the Ducks goalie. He's originally from Montreal, where hockey is a religion. He says the only way to lure fans is simple. Win.
The difference here in Southern California is you need to have a good team. You need to be successful. You need to be the talk of the town, and people will get behind you. And when people get behind you here, it's so exciting. You know, I've experienced it 2 years ago, and there's nothing like it.
Besides the fans and players, there are plenty of others who are rooting for the Ducks. When the team wins, that means more people buying souvenirs, staying in nearby hotels, and eating and drinking in bars and restaurants. Quite simply, more wins, more fans, more dollars. For Only a Game, I'm Jason Margolis in Anaheim.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the case for and against the NBA at home and abroad. But first, the early going in women's college basketball has produced a very few upsets and an awful lot of mismatches brutal enough to have fans cringing. Joining me now to discuss the women's collegiate hoop season is Michelle Smith of the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
Duke 110, Fairfield 44. LSU 107, Southern 39, Ohio State 85, Eastern Kentucky 38, Tennessee 83, Stetson 33. I could go on, but you get the point. Why does the season start with mismatches like that?
Well, you know, it does and it doesn't. I mean, the women's game certainly, you know, you go through the season and women's teams are much more willing, it seems, than some other men's basketball, and certainly, say, in football, to play top teams. But I think everybody starts out scheduling for success, let's just say.
Everybody at the top, at least.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, I know, you know, the team I cover out here, Stanford, went to the Minnesota tournament, ended up getting Minnesota, you know, on the second day of the tournament, you know, and they lost. And they've got Texas Tech coming up this week, and they've got Tennessee coming in next week. But you start out, you know, you want to schedule some teams, get a good start, and then you start bringing in the heavies.
Among those charged with ranking teams, Duke got a lot of votes for number one. The Blue Devils have won their first three games by 26, 37, and 64 points. So I don't imagine they're about to slip much in the rankings.
No, I wouldn't think so. You know, Duke has a lot of players back. They have Monique Curry. They looked like the number one team to start the season, even with Tennessee and Candace Parker being able to play. I think there were quite a few votes for Tennessee on the number one. I think they split the polls in the first preseason poll. But Duke is, you know, I think for now, Duke looks like the best team in the country.
You have to go almost to the bottom of the top 20 teams to find Temple. But this is the team that may have the player the WNBA teams will be watching most closely this season, even if the rest of us don't get to see Temple on TV very often. How far can Candace Dupree take the Temple Owls?
She is a great player, and she's one of those players who's come along who, you know, along the lines of Shamequa Holzclaw and Diana Taurasi, they talk about those players who are going to elevate the women's game. But Temple's very good, and, you know, you love that Dawn Staley, you know, this, you know, legendary player in the women's game has taken that program up. They did very well in the tournament last year. I like that team. I like them to have a long season.
Fabled and trophy-laden Connecticut is ranked 8th by some, lower by others. Can UConn be considered a long shot this year?
No, it's hard to consider Connecticut a long shot. They still don't have what they didn't have last year, which is, you know, kind of a point guard to be their floor leader and lead them along. There are a couple of holes on that team, but they've got some very good players. And, you know, Ann Strother and Sade Houston and... It's hard to envision them necessarily playing right now with Duke and Tennessee and, you know, maybe even Rutgers and that. But I think that, you know, in March, it's hard to count Connecticut out.
Speaking of long shots or potential long shots, give us a few other teams that might be legitimately designated that way this season.
Oh, I think you got to talk a little bit about the defending national champion Baylor because they lost a couple of great players, and so they've got Sophia Young, but they're going to try and make a push. And Stanford out here has got Candace Wiggins, who was the All-American freshman last year, and Brooke Smith, but they've got five seniors to replace and a lot of inexperience right now on the floor. It's going to be an interesting year because I really think there is the parity that we've been waiting for. We saw it last year in the tournament. I think it's going to sort of continue this year, but I think there are probably, you know, 10 or 12 teams legitimately who can be part of the conversation now, you know, at least until you start to get toward the tournament.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk that way because so often when I talk about women's college basketball with people, they say, oh, yeah, yeah, Tennessee, Connecticut, LSU, Old Dominion, blah, 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 Notre Dame, and then who else? And they talk about the fact that there's still this vast gulf between the very good and the still learning how to play. And I just don't think that's so much the case anymore.
I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that in the last few years at all. I think that conferences are upping their strength of schedule in the non-conference season to improve RPIs because you get teams that don't get in the tournament because you haven't played anybody, so you've got to go play people. And I think that just raises your, you know, I mean, it just raises your ability to compete. I think that there are, you know, still, you know, Tennessee, you know, Pat can still recruit there like crazy. Geno had a great recruiting year at Connecticut. There are powers in the game just as there are powers in the men's game, but I think the playing field is more level than it's ever been.
All right, teams with big dreams and old favorites notwithstanding, it's time for you to tell us which four teams will be meeting in, of all places, Boston in the spring. What fun.
Yes.
And don't worry when you make your predictions because we almost always lose the tape.
Let's see. I'm going to go with I like Duke. I like Tennessee. I like Ohio State. Jessica Davenport's a great player.
Mm-hmm.
And I like Rutgers. I like Vivian Stringer. I think that they're going to have a great season.
Vivian finally gets her crown.
Well, I'll get her to Boston. I don't know if she's going to get a crown. You know, Duke is a great team right now, and I think it'd be fun to watch them win another one. A lot of people think that Tennessee, that Pat's going to break that drought, that seven, eight-year drought, which is, you know, sort of funny. When you don't go out without an NCAA title for 7 or 8 years, it's a drought. But, you know, a lot of people think that Pat's going to get another one now.
Michelle Smith covers women's basketball for the San Francisco Chronicle. Michelle, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Over the last decade, the National Basketball Association has become increasingly international. Players from Asia, Europe, and Latin America have become critical to the success of the San Antonio Spurs, Dallas Mavericks, Houston Rockets, and other teams. But if internationalization can be seen as a triumphant development for a league constantly striving to increase its markets, much of what else characterizes the contemporary NBA has been discouraging, or so argues Harvey Araton in his new book, Crashing the Borders, subtitled How Basketball Won the World and Lost Its Soul at Home. Harvey Araton joins me now from New York City. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here.
You characterize one stretch of NBA history as the Magic Johnson-Larry Bird years and another as the time of Michael Jordan. What would you call the NBA's present?
I would call it an area of, or an era, I should say, of searching and soul searching, because I don't think the NBA, as it's currently defined, really knows what it wants to be. During the Magic and Larry era, it gained a great deal of acclaim for its team play, its core values, players who, you know, were the proverbial kind of stars who made others around them better. And then we went into the Michael Jordan era, and the league became more defined as a star vehicle. Jordan kind of became almost a one-man entity and carried the league to its greatest commercial success. And that created the question, once he retired, which way should the league go? And I think, unfortunately, they tried to go the way of replicating Michael Jordan, and I think that's failed miserably.
Part of what kind of galvanized you to write this book was the brawl just about a year ago involving players and fans at the Pistons-Pacers game. This exposed some of the game's problems. The fact that numbers of the fans regard the players as overpaid and spoiled, the gap between how David Stern thinks his players should behave and what the players themselves regard as their rights and responsibilities. When did you first become aware of these developments?
Well, I've been writing for about 10 years from the time that Kevin Garnett came out of high school and jumped directly to the pros, that something was up within the traditional developmental system in the American basketball industry that needed to be fundamentally changed. I just felt that there was a signal in the mid-90s for the NBA to start looking at its players and its player base the way baseball and hockey looks at theirs, to provide a place for those who don't want to go to college and don't want to be forced into an academic situation they may not want to be in or are prepared to be in, and provide a minor league developmental system for them to go to learn the game, to learn the fundamentals of the game. And I think that they were very slow to do that, Bill, and I think it's come back to haunt them. There have been a lot of problems with basketball players, but by the same token, the same problems exist with NFL players. And yet the NBA is constantly on the defensive because of things that its players do. And instead of looking at the industry within, instead of looking at themselves and saying, you know, gee, can we actually run this business a little better? Instead, they just point the fingers at the players and say, Allen Iverson, take off your do-rag.
In researching Crashing the Borders, you went well beyond talking to NBA players and coaches and owners and commissioners. You found academics and others who regard the current NBA and major college basketball as well as something of, I'm quoting now, a minstrel show. Explain for us the reasoning behind that characterization.
At the Division I level, for the most part, we're looking at a lot of African-American kids who come from schools in the inner city, many of whom are really not academically prepared to go to the universities they attend. They seldom are part of the main academic student body. And if you look around the stands, what you have are largely, overwhelmingly white audiences of middle and upper middle class kids and alumni. You know, you can make the strong argument, and I do, that these kids are basically, they're brought in as entertainment for middle and upper middle class America. You hear this so much about when players go to college for 1 year, oh, they should stay for 2 or 3 years, oh, they shouldn't jump from high school, they should go to become a better person. And yet, by the same token, you never hear that about, let's say, Sidney Crosby, who was a hockey player mm-hmm. who jumped from high school this year and was immediately hailed as the savior of the NHL. Or you didn't hear that about Kobe Clemens, Roger Clemens' son, when he left high school and had a full scholarship offer to the University of Texas, thought about it for a couple of minutes and decided, heck, you know, I want to be a pro baseball player. So I think you start to get these judgments of basketball players that you don't get elsewhere, and I think that's part of this. That's because of the system that sort of exploits and manipulates them into situations they may not want to be in.
Harvey, TV ratings for the NBA are considerably lower than they were during Michael Jordan's glory days. To what extent is marketing the league in China and Europe and elsewhere the same strategy that tobacco companies are employing these days? Namely, hey, we can't sell the product here, we'll sell it somewhere else.
I don't think the NBA necessarily believes that the answer to all of its problems domestically is selling in China and selling in Europe. Obviously, that's part of it. But this is still the home front, and this is where you have to put people into the seats in the arenas, and this is where you still get the lion's share of the TV money. And I think they are truly concerned about the domestic decline in the television ratings, but I think, again, they seem to go at it consistently the wrong way. And I think that what they ought to do and what they should have done when Jordan retired was say, you know, we can't replicate that. You can't manufacture a legend. What we need to do is take a hard look at our core product, the teams, the balance, the game itself. Is it fun to watch? Is it entertaining? I think they took their eye off the ball for several years there. You know, first it was Kobe Bryant, then it was Vince Carter, now it's LeBron James. You're not going to create another Michael Jordan. I think last year we saw San Antonio and Detroit in the finals, which I thought was a very good basketball series. Two teams that play together. Their stars were not me-first players. Yes, the ratings didn't set anyone on fire, but I think the long-term message to the basketball fan was, yes, it's about basketball. And I think the NBA may have to take a hit in ratings to just basically step back and say, you know what, we've got to send that message to American basketball fans, particularly baby boomers who grew up with Larry Bird and Magic Johnson and with those great Celtics and Lakers team, that it's about the game again. It's about the core product. It's not about selling jerseys and what I call the shoe company agenda.
Harvey Ariton has been a sports columnist for the New York Times for 15 years, and he is the author of Crashing the Borders, How Basketball Won the World and Lost Its Soul at Home, published by Free Press. Harvey, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's my pleasure.
You're listening to Only a Game. Our examination last week of Major League Baseball's new anti-amphetamine policy provoked this response from Paul Ippolito of Rochester, New York. This could be the most amazing sports story of 2005, he emailed. Have you ever seen a baseball game? Amphetamines? Are you sure you didn't mean to say barbiturates? This story must be a hoax. I demand an investigation. In our November 5th show, I talked curling with Anna Arthe, who had taken the photographs featured in a curling calendar. This delighted Dean Gemmel, who listens to Only a Game online. He wrote, "Thanks for supporting curling. It's a game that represents everything good in sports, honesty, camaraderie, and rewards for talent and practice." Following our November 12th show, which featured a story by Michael Cavanaugh on a program in which soccer players and coaches are teaching children in the Dominican Republic about HIV and AIDS, Michael Curtis, who hears Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio, called to say that he appreciated that story and also to point out a problem in it.
The reporter referenced a program like this being done in Zimbabwe, but unfortunately referred to Zimbabwe on the west coast of Africa. I suggest that the reporter check an atlas, because it's not too complicated to see that Zimbabwe is actually a landlocked country in the center of Africa.
Another caller to the listener line offered to upgrade the Only a Game entertainment suite.
I was calling to give you some good news. Now, you've actually been selected to receive a complete four-room digital satellite TV system for free.
But wait, is there more? No? My story preceding the Major League Soccer Championship mentioned several of the MLS teams playing in soccer-specific stadia, one of which, Pizza Hut Park in Frisco, Texas, was the sold-out site of the championship game, a fact that did not much impress Bob Cavanaugh, a WBUR listener. 20,000 is something to crow about, he asked rhetorically. Yeah, it's a sellout, but in a small venue, MLS is still minor league no matter how hard NPR pushes it. The easiest way to reach us is through the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.vu.edu. Our other address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line, especially if I won something else, by calling 617-353-1860. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Soccer, as you've never before heard of it, and not just because it's in Sierra Leone. But first, a discussion of the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Preseason basketball tournaments do not necessarily provide the most exciting games. Why didn't anybody remind the men's teams from Gonzaga and Michigan State of that before Tuesday night's tilt?
I watched every second. I started watching the beginning of the game because there wasn't anything else on TV, and at quarter of one or whatever it was, I was wrung out.
How many overtimes? Three,
including a 12-9 third overtime.
Fantastic.
When people are dragging a couple of players who played 53 minutes, two really good teams. Adam Morrison had a real coming out party. He had 43 points, the forward from Gonzaga. That was the best regular season basketball game I've ever seen on television.
It has been a season of comebacks from potentially life-threatening physical problems for a few pro athletes. Charlie, Teddy Bruschi, of course, returned to the New England Patriots following a stroke. Eddie Curry has been examined for heart irregularities, but now he's playing for the Knicks. Does this portend well for Yuri Fisher of the Detroit Red Wings?
Yeah, I mean, one hopes so. He collapsed on the bench and was revived with an on-site defibrillator. And I would say that a number of years ago, he probably dies on the spot. But if you remember, the collapse and death of Hank Gathers in a Loyola Marymount started a movement to have on-site defibrillators, and Yuri Fisher is alive because of one.
Soccer star George Best died this week at the age of 59. Is he, in fact, one of a handful of soccer players who should be up there considered as one of the best ever?
If you had, like, and boy, do I not want this to happen, an international sport hall of fame, he would be one of the soccer players. And I heard of George Best when I was a kid, and there was no soccer on TV except the delayed broadcast on ABC Wide World of Sports of the Premier League Cup.
Mm-hmm.
George Best was a soccer player so prominent he made it into Monty Python routines. And so, yes, prior to Pele, he was probably the only soccer player I'd ever heard of.
Following last week's World Cup qualifier, in which Turkish fans whistled over the Swiss national anthem, FIFA President Sepp Blatter said the national anthems may be skipped entirely before international matches. Good idea?
First of all, the drunks are all going to sing theirs anyway, uh-huh. So you might as well play them with some manner of respect, and perhaps there'll be 3 or 4 people who are sober enough to remember the lyrics. Second of all, what's the problem with the Swiss national anthem? Third of all, what is the Swiss national anthem?
I have a
Not our problem anyway. Not our problem anyway. We make clocks. We make chocolate. Not our problem anyway.
The eagerly anticipated Poinsettia Bowl matchup is in. Charlie, it's Colorado State against Navy. Both of them apparently believe poinsettias are nice.
That's right.
Do you like poinsettias?
Do you get a bowl full of... They're poisonous, by the way. I don't know if you knew that. Poinsettias are deadly poison.
I have never even been remotely tempted to eat one.
So don't eat one out of the bowl if you win the football game. As with every time we announce the bowl schedule, I always check to see who's playing on my birthday, December 28th. This year, my birthday will be livened up by the MPC Computers Bowl in Boise, Idaho, and the MasterCard Alamo Bowl in San Antonio, Texas, which I believe is the one I'll be watching. And let us not forget that on December 31st, New Year's Eve day, the Meineke Car Care Bowl will go head-to-head for a time with the AutoZone Liberty Bowl, and the two winners will play for the Out-of-Town Suburban Strip Mall Championship of North America, the trophy of which is a mud flap.
After a September 19th kerfuffle in which several people apparently prayed too close to air ducts while President Bush was in attendance, Giants Stadium officials have set aside a special area for Muslim fans who want to pray during games. Does this set a precedent for sports stadia around the country?
Once I went to a World Cup qualifier in Qatar, as I've told you before, and in the middle of a game, virtually the entire body of spectators left and went out into the aisles to face Mecca,
mm-hmm.
to pray,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the most amazing phenomena I've ever seen in a sporting event. The game was like South Korea and Japan, but they were all the local people who would. So I don't know. I mean, I guess we hang around and wait till somebody gets the naming rights.
Pete Rose is 64 years old, Charlie, and he won't appear on the Hall of Fame ballot this time around again. So if he is ever to get in, he'll have to be voted in by the Veterans Committee. How do you like Rose's chances with that lot?
Oh, see, he's got a better chance with the current electorate of young baseball writers than he has with the old dudes who've decided they really don't like him. Although, I'm telling you, with the Veterans Committee, if he's going to be allowed to be considered by the Veterans Committee, which is another thing, he should be on the ballot because it's not Major League Baseball's ballot. It's the baseball writers, and they caved a few years ago when the commissioner told them to take Rose off the ballot because he might have won. The only reason he's not on the ballot is the fact that he might win. It will be interesting to see if they even allow the Veterans Committee to consider him.
In contemporary baseball, the Florida Marlins have let their best pitcher go. They've let their best everyday player go. Their setup guy is gone as well. The former Red Sox and the Mets are the beneficiaries. And I understand you can get a great deal on rosin bags and batting practice balls if you call 1-800-MIAMI-FIRE-SALE right now. Beyond all that, where do you suppose the Marlins are going to be playing in a couple of years?
Well, first of all, the despicable chop shop operator Jeffrey Loria should never have been allowed to own another baseball team. That's number one. Number two, the Marlins have done what they could. They won two World Series, and they still can't draw. But don't you get the feeling that one day you'll drive by the Marlins headquarters, and there'll be, like, a bunch of players on the front lawn with, like, tags hanging from their ear and a little girl selling lemonade and a bunch of people browsing and going, "Oh, it'll look good in the den here. The reliever will look fine in the den."
And finally, Charlie, Americans won two gold medals and a silver medal to finish first at the World Gaming Championships, which are widely regarded as the Olympics of the computer gaming world. And so the long national nightmare of basketball bronze is over, yes?
And I have to admit, we did give the rest of the world a shot because one of the sports games, we didn't use Madden, which is American football, which nobody else plays. We did FIFA Football 2005, and we still won. So our thumbs are number one, baby.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game for a brisk round of Counter-Strike. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
After his recent assignment to cover the Liberian presidential election for Only a Game, reporter Ken Shulman went north of the border and met with a group of athletes thankful to have survived a brutal civil war and to have earned the opportunity to demonstrate that much can be learned about war and about peace via a very simple game.
The swaying palms, the pounding surf, young men trading jokes while juggling a sand-worn soccer ball, postcards from an idyllic tropical beach. Except it's not idyllic.
So the other guy who was the commander, he's called Ba. He ordered one of the little boy, about 12 years old, to come with an axe. So this boy came with the axe.
Jabati Mambu is a member of the Single Leg Amputee Soccer Club in Sierra Leone. His team, one of several amputee teams across the country, practices every Saturday morning on Freetown's Aberdeen Beach. Because he lost a hand and not a foot or leg, Jabati plays in goal. His one-legged teammates play on crutches. In January 1999, during an offensive in Sierra Leone's 10-year civil war, a breakaway group of government soldiers descended on Jabati's Freetown neighborhood. He saw that some of the soldiers carried rifles, while others carried axes. He didn't know what the axes were for. Then the group's commander ordered him to lay his left hand on the bare floor. Jabati was 14 years old.
I said, "Before he chopped off my hand, let me join you." I said, "No, they don't need any more recruit." I said, "Well, you can see I'm a student." I removed my student ID card and showed it to them, and he was annoyed. And he said, "Well, now I'm not going to chop off your right hand because you use it to write." So immediately he chopped off my right hand.
There was another giving for soldiers to go down the eastern part of Freetown to amputate up to 200 civilians and send them to the ferry junction.
Stories like Jabati's, while shocking, aren't rare in this impoverished West African nation. The war left thousands of amputees in Freetown, and many more in the provinces. A few war criminals have been brought to justice here, at the UN-backed Special Court for War Crimes in Sierra Leone. Many other offenders, including former child soldiers, are themselves traumatized and live on the streets. From 1991 to 2001, rebel, renegade, and government forces battled for control of the country's rich deposits of diamonds, timber, and minerals. The war took nearly 100,000 lives and displaced nearly a third of Sierra Leone's 5.6 million inhabitants. But the amputations forever branded the conflict. Lansana Fofana is a Freetown-based journalist and political analyst. For him and for other residents of the capital, amputees are a common sight.
As we are talking now, you can see one on my left sitting with both hands chopped off. So this is a brutal reminder, certainly, of what happened during the war. There certainly is a sense of shame. I mean, people do understand how this country was brought down by the acts of brutality committed during the years of war by Sierra Leoneans against Sierra Leoneans. So certainly there is a sense of shame, a sense of betrayal.
From 1999 to 2004, this muddy ramshackle market in the Aberdeen section of Freetown served as a camp for amputees. In the camp, amputees like Jabati Mambu found some solidarity in shared misfortune, but they also found despair. Mohamed Lapia is a 21-year-old student and midfielder on the single-leg amputee soccer club. He lost his leg at the age of 15 when he stepped on a landmine while walking home from school. He recalls the day the mood in camp started to change, the day a minister they call Pastor arrived.
And went to us in the camp. "You people, I don't want you to sit like that. I have good news for you. Those people who have one leg, they know how to play good football. And I know that it's not easy to play football with one leg, but I want you to courage and play it so it will be success for you."
When Pastor first came to you and said you guys can play football, did you think he was crazy?
Yeah, we think that he's crazy. We think that he's provoking us because we have one leg.
Soccer is by far the most popular sport in Sierra Leone. Boys, girls, and men on the street sport jerseys and caps from Arsenal, Liverpool, and AC Milan. For Mahmoud Samai, the 32-year-old minister known as Pastor, soccer was a natural lure to draw the amputees towards recovery and a return to life.
They believe they can play football and also can do more other things because you can find out that among the team we have people that have already done some software programs in computer, and they are now doing very well in their training sessions. They have some of them have already learned tailoring skill trainings, and so they are making clothes, and so it's like they can play football, and after training sessions they are engaged in their small businesses.
It's Saturday morning on Aberdeen Beach. 10 members of the single-leg amputee soccer club run through their paces on the sand. On the shoreline, further down, three women balancing baskets on their heads pause to watch, halfway between interest and disbelief. Many of the passing cars slow to watch as well. The workouts are intense, with scrimmages and with drills designed to teach dribbling, trapping, and shooting skills. Last winter, thanks to a generous donation from Holland, the Freetown team was able to travel to Brazil and take part in the World Amputee Soccer Championships. In Rio, they learned they don't yet measure up against the world's best sides. They also learned that amputee soccer can be a little rough. Midfielder Mohamed Lapia.
When you are playing, some of our colleagues kick the clutch and fall on the ground. So it's not easy, but for now it's okay because we are already used with this.
Kong, 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 na uda de waya, na wio. Kong, 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 na uda.
This is the Amputee Soccer Club's welcome song, written in Creole, the Freetown dialect. The words are based on a passage from the Gospel according to Matthew and invoke brotherly love. And there is a sense of relief in hearing these amputees sing, in watching them play, as if their return to sport heralded a true and lasting return to peace for Sierra Leone. And perhaps it has. Yet despite the therapeutic effect of soccer, despite the comforts of scripture, these young men still struggle. Mohamed Sila Kamara plays forward for the single-leg amputee soccer club. In 1998, he was shot in the leg while trying to flee a rebel attack on his village. He lay bleeding in the bush for 3 days, without food or water, without assistance. Today, Silly is one of the club's success stories. He has a job, is married, and has fathered a daughter. Still, he can't help feeling rage each time he looks down at the bandaged stump where his leg once was.
Yeah, I'm hungry because they destroy our village. They kill a lot of people. They rape a lot of our sisters in the village. And secondly, they bulleted my leg. Today I have become an amputee. So I was not so happy, and I will not forgive them. And indeed, I will not forget. Anytime that I see my leg amputated, I will not forget.
Silla also feels resentment that his government and the international community paid more attention to the needs of the ex-combatants than it did to those of the amputees.
They have given them a package, and they have given them educational facilities. But we, the victim of the country, the government did not want to do anything for us. Because today we have peace because of this amputation, that the international people see our brothers are amputating us. That's why the international people come in. So today they have done something for these people who did this crime in this country. What about the victim?
The swaying palms, the pounding surf, the most visible victims of a vicious conflict, singing in the sun. It all adds up to a pretty picture. Unless you subtract the week's earnings that each player spends on bus fare to and from the beach, and the second week's wage he spends on a liter of clean drinking water. Or try and factor the loss of a limb into the already tragic equation of lost families, lost homes, and lost years written by the war. The figures don't augur well for anyone in Sierra Leone, a country still mired in poverty, unemployment, and endemic corruption. They're even bleaker for these young men, however brave, with a poisoned past, a compromised future, and a present where they can barely afford their single soccer shoes. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Greg Fazio and from Splash Studios in New York. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view photos of Ken Schulman's trip to Sierra Leone, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Sporting News football scribe Paul Attner, who admits that the Lions-Falcons game wasn't a Thanksgiving Day priority.
Well, the turkey was being digested when I was watching.
Is that another way of saying you were asleep? Wait a minute. Attner asleep during a football game? I want an investigation. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.